Missing ships, missing planes, and missing people, all disappearing without a trace. What makes some places more prone to mysterious activity? Are there reasonable explanations? Or could something otherworldly be at play?
You totally made that up. We are a bi-weekly history podcast that focuses on stories from yesteryear that are weird, strange, unusual, crazy, nutty. You know, the kinds of stories that sound like someone must have totally made them up. We particularly go for the ones that contain some sort of supernatural, paranormal, magical parts to them. But still, the stories are all true, even if those parts are only true to the people who live them. So we're not doing the whole the lore says or the legend goes stuff. We want names and dates and all the facts we can find. And my name is Nash.
And my name is Tiff.
We are your hosts. This episode's topic is about mysterious places, areas where seemingly inexplicable things have occurred, specifically disappearances. So do you want to go ahead and spill the beans and tell them what you're going to be talking about, Tiff?
The Bermuda Triangle.
That's a good one.
It is a good one. I promise it's good, you guys.
Because what were we saying? Because we did talk about, we try not to tell each other too much about what we're doing, but we do have to double check that we're not.
Yeah, we're not crossing the streams
right.
Too much.
So what did we say that the pro was that there's going to be lots of information out there. And then the con was that there's
lots of information. Yeah. Kind of narrowing it down and trying to find those fun little bits that maybe you don't know about. That was a little tougher for this one. Yeah, what about you?
Well, I myself am going to be covering the disappearance of the Roanoke colony.
Ooh, it's a mystery.
Yeah, well, sort. It's like, oh, everybody's done that story, Nash. We've already heard that story. Shut up. You know I'm going to tell it better. Old listeners, y'all tell the new ones. I ain't lying.
It's true.
Speaking of new listeners, that's the way to sell them, telling them to shut up.
Just shut up and listen. Open up your ears and shut your mouth.
You know, and look, I'm a little stir crazy. I think the lack of in-person human contact is making me more blunt, but sincerely, the both of us, we want to gain new listeners, we swear. I tell you though, I've been, as I sip my wine, so this might be the cause of me being more blunt. And I was just telling Tiff, I got worked up. We don't like to get into like personal lives and stuff on this because that's not what you came here for. You came here to hear stories. I will warn you, there's an outside chance that the podcast is going to have to go on a little mini hiatus later on because I'm about to have some major dental surgery and it's going to make me talk funny for several months because there's going to be a series of procedures as I heal.
I hate to break it to you, but you already talk funny.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, no. So we're trying to stack episodes. And so I got worked up talking about that again because I'm so angry that it's one of those things where, honest to God, if I'd have done something to myself and brought it upon myself, that'd be one thing. It's something that is not my fault. Legit. It's a long story and I'm not going to get into it because nobody cares. But I tell you, I think my tolerance level is down and I've been approaching the precipice talking about getting new listeners of doing some really dangerous marketing in that arena because everybody in podcast land is totally nice and sweet and supportive. And then I apparently am the evil goon over on the side who's thinking, God, well, okay, here's the good thing, but I don't want to step on toes. There's a lot of podcasts that I think we're in league with. And every time I see comments on Twitter or wherever, I want to reply to them and be like, when I see listeners complimenting others, part of me wants to reply to them and go, well, God, if you like them, for real, you will definitely like us. The goon in me, though, is when I see the ones that are gushing over, I mean, there's some dogs out there, y'all. And I think, God, if they think that XYZ podcast is the epitome of quality and research and humor and quirkiness or whatever. Pick a category. I mean, Jesus wept. They're going to think we're...
goddesses among men. Yes.
Because if they think that's great, their hair's going to get blown back if they ever try us. So part of me wants to hit reply and go, listen. Come over here and sit by us. just let us talk to you for a while. And then that makes me a bitch. And then, so no, I'm not going to do that marketing. I'm not. And this whole thing might get edited out and put on the YouTube channel. Because that's another thing we do is we put rants or extraneous information over on the YouTube channel. Or this might never see the light of day. Or hell, it might be the featured clip. Look, I don't know. Let's see how I feel by the end. If I'm drinking more wine when I'm editing. We'll find out, won't we? So should I go first or should you go first? It really doesn't matter. I know that next time you're going first, but I think that last time you also went first, but I really don't care if you go first again. It's up to you.
No, you go ahead.
You want me to go ahead?
I want you to go ahead because you're on a roll.
I'm on a roll? All right. I take you to August 18th, 1590, to an island off the coast of what is now North Carolina in the U.S., and there, an English ship called the Hopewell has just set anchor. The people on the ship were pumped because they see smoke rising from the little island of Roanoke, which one passenger in particular took as a good sign, writing that it, quote, put us in good hope that some of the colony were there expecting my return out of England. And why his return specifically? Well, because he was the governor of the colony, John White. And he had family there, and he was also happy because this was the second run at establishing this colony. More on that in a second. Now, I'm different. I'd be afraid that much smoke visible from a distance could indicate something was awry, but what do I know? Their impression was that this meant that the colony was kicking it, that everything was going well, and they'd been concerned about that since they'd left on a supply run for the colony and had been delayed. But hey, we're here now. What they find, though, is not a thriving community. Instead, what they find is a ghost town. But let's back up. Like I say, this was not the first go at establishing a colony in this area. Queen Elizabeth, back in the early 1580s, had put Sir Walter Raleigh in charge of getting colonizing going in North America, and there was this sailing route known to them that the Spanish would take when going to get gold and silver from Mexico and Peru. Sir Raleigh's looking at maps and sends a ship to check out the area of North Carolina that kind of edges out into this route, where there's a sprinkling of little islands. In 1584, he sends a ship to there, and by all accounts, the natives they encountered were really friendly, and they tell this group that this one island, Roanoke, is worth checking out. They do, and they dig it. Quote, based on the brief visit, Roanoke was described as a land filled with crops, game, and welcoming Indians, a new Eden. Well, how lovely. Raleigh's really pleased, and he turns around and immediately orders another expedition for 1585, this time a military one, commanded by Ralph Lane, who was a cousin of the Queen's stepmother. Also along for the ride was Raleigh's cousin, Richard Grenville, and he was apparently a bit of a douche. Quote, the voyage proved difficult as Lane quarreled with the aggressive leadership of Grenville, whom he found a person of intolerable pride and insatiable ambition. He would do shit like ingratiate himself with the Spanish while on the side he was behind some privateering against their ships that were on that route. And privateering, we've talked about that in Pirates episode. That's essentially just robbing ships like pirates did. It was just on the books rather than off. Oh, and also, quote, after an initial exploration of the continental coast and its Indian settlements, Grenville accused the natives of one village, Aquasagoc, of stealing a silver cup, and in retaliation, looted and burned the village. Just a real peach of a guy.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to go well for him.
Yeah, he's a real diplomat here, you know. Y'all took my shiny. Who cares? Man, who cares? Anyway, so his ship got separated from the others, and he gets impatient waiting on them, so he sails on and ends up grounding it and ruining most of the supplies. But regardless, in August of 1585, he leaves Lane and a little over 100 settlers on Roanoke. They whip up a little mini fort, and in more shows of diplomacy, quote, contact was quickly made with the local Native Americans. The English treated them with suspicious harshness. On several occasions, the colonists kidnapped Indians to extort supplies or extract information.
Oh, man. All right.
I know. Then Grenville pieces out, telling them he'll be back in April with more shit. April comes and goes, and in the meantime, word of that whole stolen cup village burndown incident had been circulating amongst the Native American populace, and they attacked the fort, which did prove unsuccessful, but left the colony really beat down. And of course, tensions are still off the charts. Molly, you in danger, girl, is what's going on. Then, in June, Sir Francis Drake and his ship stopped by Roanoke, and he's all, "Hey, Lane, y'all need a ride?" And Lane's all, "Yes, get us the hell out of here." So they hitch a ride with Drake back to England. In a small bit of comeuppance, Grenville's ships showed back up not long after they'd already gone. So, you know, screw him. I'm glad he wasted a trip.
Yeah, sucker.
Suck it. But the attempt at colonizing wasn't a total bust because Raleigh did get some valuable info. He had sent a mathematician and a scientist named Thomas Harriot along for the ride, as well as our buddy John White, who was a proficient artist. And together they ended up getting a lot accomplished. They teamed up to make these incredible maps and navigation charts. And then White also did a ton of art depicting the landscape and what the natives looked like. They're all really beautiful, and I'm sticking a couple of his things in show notes. Harriet collected lots of samples for analysis back home. And another thing they did was learn the Algonquian language from a Native American man called Manteo, who was, quote, "a noble from the friendly coastal Croatoan tribe." And keep that tribe tucked in your mind. Fast forward a bit. White volunteers to take and lead a civilian group back over in an attempt to colonize again. And in the summer of 1587, White and about 115 people, including some children, arrive at North Carolina. And about them, quote, "most of the group that sailed with him seems to have come from London, of artisan and middle-class backgrounds. Entire families joined the second colony, while others sailed expecting their families to follow. Economic opportunity was probably the main reason for their immigration, though religious freedom may also have been important." Okay, so here's the thing. Raleigh had told White that the settlers should start the colony in Chesapeake Bay, and they decided to go and do it about 50 miles inland. But for whatever reason, the captain of the ship said he wouldn't take them any further than Roanoke Island. End quote. When the group arrived, they found the Roanoke settlement empty, the fort in ruins, and the mainland Indians hostile. To compound matters, an accident in landing led to the spoilage of much of the food supplies. After taking steps to repair existing cottages and build additional ones, the colony's leaders decided that a direct appeal to Raleigh was needed. So, in layman's terms, they were up shit creek without a paddle, and they couldn't think of what else to do but for White to go back to England. In the meantime, though, a couple of cool events happened. First off, White's daughter Eleanor and her husband Ananias were part of the group, and Eleanor gave birth to the first English child born in America, a girl named Virginia Dare. The other thing was that Manteo, the Native American leader that they'd become friends with, was baptized as a Christian and inducted as Lord of Roanoke. The Christian thing I don't care about, but I think that's cool that they kind of inducted him as a lord. I thought that was neat. I had never heard that before.
Yeah.
Quote, "these two events must have been seen by White and all those present as the beginning of a colonial-born population and the integration of Indians into Elizabethan religious and political structures." And by the way, when I say friends, when I refer to, you know, them as friendly and that Manteo was a friend, I'm not being flippant. Manteo had been really helpful to them. He'd actually been back and forth to London twice and had been a guide and translator for them. And at this time, he was trying to help smooth things over with another tribe called the Wanchese. Because talking about what they had found when they arrived, quote, "White's party located the site of the colony." So talking about where Lane and his people had tried to set up. "The fort had been dismantled while the houses stood vacant and overgrown with melons. There was no sign that Grenville's men had ever been there except for human bones that White believed were the remains of one of them, killed by Native Americans." And turns out he was right because, quote, "with the help of Manteo, the Croatoan described how a coalition of mainland tribes led by the Wanchese had attacked Grenville's detachment." And let me stop here for a second. The Croatoan knew this because they were very close by. The island where they lived, which the settlers called Croatoan, and later it's become known as Hatteras, it's about 64 miles away, which, yeah, is a decent distance, but apparently they were going back and forth quite a bit. But of course, they weren't the only tribe who lived on or would frequent Roanoke, like I say. All right, so White leaves for England on August 27th, 1587, and he gets there on November 5th, but he couldn't just regroup with, I imagine, some military support along with supplies, and here's why. War was breaking out between Spain and England, and quote, by this time, reports of the Spanish Armada mobilizing for an attack had reached London, and Queen Elizabeth had prohibited any able ship from leaving England so that they might participate in the coming battle. Big fat rut-row.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward, in March, White gets permission to tag along with some of the fleet that was headed to the Caribbean, and I guess then branch off and cut over to the American coast. But then bad winds delayed them, and then the military orders changed, so there goes his escort. Then in April, White is given permission to make the trip back with two small ships that weren't suitable for battle. But in early May, they get attacked by French pirates off of Morocco. The ships are looted, some crew is killed, and they have no option but to go back to England. And then, even though the Spanish Armada was defeated, the Queen still had a lockdown on shipping because they were busy with assembling their own bigger armada to counterattack in 1589. So White doesn't get the okay until 1590. Y'all, 3 years. 3 years. He was supposed to be back in a few months.
Yikes.
Big fat yikes. So now we've returned to where we began, and White has arrived on what would be his granddaughter Virginia Dare's third birthday. Here's what they found. None of the colony's boats were docked at the shore. There was a defensive barrier put up, which hadn't been there years prior. Having said that, there was no indication that they'd been attacked, at least not to the detriment of the colony. Within the barrier, where the houses were, everything was, you know, overrun with weeds and crap, and all of them had been stripped down. Anything that could be carried off was gone. Multiple trunks of valuables, three of which happened to be White's, full of belongings that he had buried, were dug up and the contents gone. And then there were the carvings. Now, before he left, they had all agreed that the colonists would leave a message saying where they went if they needed to cut out for whatever reason, and that they would add a cross to it if they were leaving under distress. There wasn't a cross, so that tracks with there being no sign of a massacre or something, but in a tree trunk, there were three letters, C-R-O. Then in a fence post was the word Croatoan, you know, like that island where their native friends lived.
Okay.
And I want to stop here and point out something that I didn't read anywhere, but for me, that CRO means nothing, because I bet you money they started to carve Croatoan into a tree trunk, and one of two things happened. One, they realized they'd run out of room. Or two, they realized it was a shit ton easier to carve a decently long word like that into a flat fence post. I'm just saying. But all right, White has a lead, and he's encouraged because they found no burial sites or remains, and one would think the first thing they'd do was hightail it down to Croatoan Island. However, the same stellar luck that had been following them this whole time kicks up again, and turns out one of the anchor cables has snapped. Now, I know dick about sailing, but apparently this meant that they couldn't safely put down at this little island that's like 64 miles away. Whatever. But apparently they could spend the winter in the Caribbean and return in the spring of 1591, which is what the captain told White he was willing to do. Again, just floating out at sea, I guess. I don't get it. What about that changes their anchor situation? I don't get it. In any event, that's what they do. But then on their way, they get blown off course, and then they start running out of supplies, and they were going to stop someplace else. Then bad winds keep them from doing that, so they had to go back to England, where they arrive in October. White would never return to America or get to investigate Croatoan or ever know what happened to his daughter or his family.
Aww.
I know. Theories abound for what happened to these people, the stupidest of which have to do with witchcraft or Native American, you know, not voodoo, but, you know, Native American spiritualist type stuff.
Uh-huh.
And of course, alien abduction. Never discount alien abduction as a theory. Now, the wildest one, though, that I read was that supposedly, many years later, John Smith claimed that Powhatan, you know, Pocahontas' dad, claimed that he'd killed off the colony. I mean, what?
I don't know if I want to really listen to John Smith and all of them about that.
I know, right? They, again, as far as considering the source goes, Then there's the most likely one, which is that, at least initially, due to either threats from hostile local natives or lack of supplies, or both, They sought out help from their friends, the Croatoans, over on their island, and stuff has turned up over the years that give more clues. I take you now to 1937, and a dude turns up at Emory University and says to a geologist there that he was a tourist who found a 21-pound flat-ish stone near the North Carolina-Virginia border and needed someone to help him figure out the carvings on it. Quote, when a team of Emory scholars deciphered the carved message, they were stunned to find a heart-rending plea from a grieving daughter to her father, detailing the bloody murder of her husband and child. The writer claimed to be Eleanor Dare, and the message was addressed to her absent father, Governor John White. The carefully carved letters told a bone-chilling story. Father, soon after you go for England, we came hither, the tale begins. The colonists suffered 2 years of only misery and war that led to the death of more than half the settlers. Tragedy struck when Indian shamans warned that the spirits were angry, and all the remaining English, save seven, were abruptly killed. Among the dead were Virginia Dare and Ananias, so her husband and child. Yowza.
That is sad.
The exact spot the tourists found it was about 50 miles inland from Roanoke, which is just where the settlers had originally planned on starting the colony before that captain on the initial arrival had said, no, I'm not taking you to the mainland. Okay, remember? Okay.
Yes.
So the Emory team declares it authentic, but not so fast. Not long after, a Georgia man who was a stonecutter, him, said that he'd found over 36 stones that had carvings that continued the story, basically saying that Eleanor Dare and the remaining colonists had ended up someplace not far from what is now Atlanta, Georgia. In the meantime, the Emory folks were starting to back off of their appraisal because they couldn't track down the original dude, that tourist, in order to ask him more questions, but it was too late to unring the proverbial bell. Quote, in 1940, a team of 36 experts led by the esteemed Harvard historian Samuel Eliot Morrison met at Brenau to study all the rocks. They declared that the preponderance of evidence points to the authenticity of the stones. Well, enter my people, the skeptics. This is my tribe. A reporter with the Saturday Evening Post wrote this in-depth investigative article in 1941 and proved that the Georgia stonecutter, duh, to be a fraud. Again.
Imagine that.
A stonecutter magically finds 36 stones with, you know, cuttings in them. And it actually ended up, as one of my sources put it, damaging academic careers. And he was right. The stones were stuck in a basement for years until 2016 when a geologist took another look at them and verified that they were indeed forgeries. But that original stone is still up for debate. So, you know, stay tuned. Maybe one day somebody will kind of dig into that one a little bit more. But for now, the consensus seems to be that they're all fake. Moving on. Archaeologists have examined the hell out of the original site at Roanoke over the years. But the most interesting stuff has turned up in recent past. And over on Hatteras, which, as I mentioned, is what Croatoan Island is now called, quote, since 2013, the team has uncovered a variety of old world objects mixed in with Native American artifacts in the heart of a village. They include the remains of what appears to be a gentleman's dress sword called a rapier, along with some scraps of European copper, the barrel of a gun, lead shot, and a piece of drawing slate with its lead pencil. Having said that, quote, yet most of the objects that appear Elizabethan were found alongside other material, such as tiny glass beads and broken pottery that likely date to more than half a century after White's failed rescue attempt. It's deeply problematic that this stuff turns up two generations later, University of Bristol archaeologist Mark Horton admits. He suggests that the older Elizabethan objects may have been kept by the children or grandchildren of abandoned settlers who may have assimilated with the Croatoan. But even some members of the excavation team suspect the material could have arrived through trade with later English settlements. But again, still doesn't mean that that other stuff wasn't from the Roanoke group. And interestingly, another of my sources pointed out that there is documentation that Spaniards who sailed past the Outer Banks during the time frame when the colonists hypothetically would have gone over to Croatoan, that while they didn't see any white folks, they quote, saw natives waving and making music on European-style musical instruments. Could mean something, could mean nothing. Dunno. Another interesting thing that was unearthed were animal bones from trash heaps that, quote, suggest an abrupt dietary switch from fish and turtles to deer and birds, evidence that could hint at indigenous people using European guns early in that contact period, guns the lost colonists may have provided. Further, another of my sources says that burial grounds were, of course, found on Croatoan, you'd expect that, but some contained coffins, and quote, "The coffins at the burial grounds have Christian markings on them, but there was no previous record of any settlement or the gravesite in this location. There is no definitive evidence that this site belonged to the missing Roanoke settlers, though." Agreed, but that's still kind of odd.
Yeah.
Like, there's no other record of English colonies on Croatoan.
But you're wondering what happened to these other people.
Sounds like you kind of have an answer. Okay. Here's another interesting find, and it has to do with some of the maps White had drawn. And of course, we know that it's legit. We know its provenance and when it was done. So these particular maps are all of eastern North Carolina. And thanks to White's work with Harriet on the cartography, they really nailed it. It is crazy super accurate.
It amazes me how old map makers were able to do what they did.
I don't have the, and you know what? I'm a decently intelligent person. I don't have fuck all clue how they did it. I have no idea. It's amazing.
Yeah.
In 2011, a professor from Chapel Hill named Brent Lane got curious about these two really faint patches that were on his map because he owned one of the originals because White and Harriet did several of each. And so after some pushing, he gets it into the hands of some curators. And by the way, it took some pushing because this isn't uncommon to see little patches on these old ass maps. It's essentially whiteout. It's how the makers would cover up mistakes. I mean, they were done like in heavy ink or watercolor. It's not like they could just erase them because they weren't sketches. You know, sketches you could kind of get away with rubbing out, but they couldn't do it on maps. So anyway, the curators backlight the map. And there was this star symbol under one of the patches that they interpreted to be a symbol for a fort. And I say star, but it's more like this diamond kind of shape. End quote. "The location of the fort was just as startling. It lay not on Roanoke Island, but some 50 miles away at the head of Albemarle Sound." So matching up with that whole 50 miles inland thing. "And on top of this patch was the barely perceptible outline of a fort as well, drawn in what may have been invisible ink made with urine, a hint that the patch was meant to conceal a secret rather than fix an error." Ooh.
Okay, all right.
Now, it just so happens that back in 2006, archaeologists had been excavating around this area and had found evidence, such as pottery and certain pieces of equipment that dates back to well before the first documented settlers in that area, which is about 1655. And it's stuff that is similar to that which had been found back at Roanoke and on Hatteras, aka Croatoan, which has led some to believe that the colonists reverted to their original plan and, with Monteo's help, came inland and settled with some trusted Native Americans. And it could have been both. As one of my sources points out, says historian Eric Klingelhofer of Mercer University, quote, "No single Indian tribe or village could have supported them. They would be even larger than some villages. It's a good strategy. We don't definitively know that they did, but it's obvious that that's the only way they could have survived." And what he means is splitting up. Some going over to Croatoan Island, and then some going inland.
Okay, that makes sense.
Right?
Yeah.
It makes sense to me. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't bring up something that I have heard for forever, and maybe y'all have too, which is that there's descendants of the Croatoan tribe still around today who have features such as light-colored hair and eyes, suggesting that there's European descent DNA happening. And on this note, I am going to link you to some videos and show notes from BuzzFeed Unsolved, which is a favorite of ours because the hosts Shane and Ryan are so delightful, because they did an episode several years ago on Roanoke. And if you're unfamiliar with their format, just to let you know, they also do follow-up videos on each of their topics, which they call postmortems, and they go through things viewers have sent in, their questions and comments. So in the postmortem for their Roanoke episode, one of the viewers said in part, quote, "I live in Robeson County, North Carolina. It is common knowledge here that the local tribe, the Lumbees, are descendants of the survivors of the lost colony and our local native population. Studies by linguist experts, not to mention the blonde hair, blue-eyed appearance of many of these folks, leave no doubt in North Carolinians' minds of their ancestry. Okay.
That person sounds pretty sure.
They are incredibly confident, right? But not everybody, including not all of the Lumbees, seem to agree with that assertion. According to a 2007 article in Natives People magazine by Ryan Wordy, local experts are split. He spoke with Fred Willard, who is the founder of the Lost Colony Center for Science and Research, quote, an organization that has focused its research on the ancestry of modern Native Americans and their possible connection to the Roanoke Colony, and has used methods as varied as deed research, archaeological digs, and satellite imaging. And Willard claims that the center has, quote, pinpointed roughly 5,000 living descendants of those displaced people, meaning the Roanoke colonists. So my brain immediately was like, huh? How? Well, the article goes on to talk about that many modern Lumbee last names match up with last names found on the roster of the original Roanoke settlers. Because, I mean, it's documented who all came over.
Mm-hmm.
And that their oral history passed down through the generations claims that an old English colony joined their tribe and it matches up with some Anglicanized traditions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and on and on. Having said that, it goes on to point out that, quote, many of the shared surnames are fairly common in English culture, and that there are many other ways the Lumbee could have come into contact with English customs and traditions. The writer also spoke with Dr. Stanley Nick, who is, or was, because, you know, it's been a minute, director of the Native American Resource Center at the University of North Carolina, Pembroke, end quote. Nick says that while many modern Lumbee believe they are descendants of the Lost Colony, perhaps just as many believe that they aren't. In fact, today's Lumbee tribe seems to downplay the Lost Colony theory, because Anglicization is a double-edged sword. While it has brought education, relative prosperity, and freedom from oppression, it has caused many observers, both native and non-native, to conclude that the Lumbee are too mixed to be considered Indians. Which, besides it not being my place to get into a discussion on such, we'd be here for days if we tried to untangle the nuances of that issue of what makes a person or a group of people Native American enough. I'm not the person to have that discussion. So back to my whole thing of how do you prove it? How could that other dude make such a claim that he tracked down like 5,000 descendants or whatever? And my science nerd brain was immediately like, has there been DNA testing done? And if so, where'd they get the samples? So it turns out there has been some DNA testing done. Not a lot by my reading, though. And listen, I had a tough time with trying to find stuff on this, on what evidence is out there for Croatoan / Lumbee tribe and Roanoke connection. I did find that, also in 2007, a woman named Roberta Estes founded the Lost Colony Roanoke Project, wherein she's using her private DNA company to test for descendants. And I mean, they do other stuff too, like using historical records and looking at migration patterns and all that good stuff. But so far, nothing has come up to show a connection. And here's my take on all this descendant and DNA stuff, and of course, taking into account that my wheelhouse ain't DNA, but I don't understand how this can be verified, because what's your comparison sample? Wouldn't they have to have a sample from a confirmed relative, who would have to be a British person, of one of the colonists, and hope that the colonists didn't die before they could procreate with a member of the tribe, and then proceed to test Lord knows how many people? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So my thing is, if they find non-native DNA in this population, why does that...
How do you narrow that down to being from that colony?
Exactly. Why does that mean it was from the Roanoke crew? We're talking hundreds and hundreds of years here. So I'm not entirely tracking.
And, you know, as far as physical attributes with, you know, blue eyes or light-colored hair, genetics, that's one of those things that I loved studying. Was, you know, dominant versus recessive traits. And yeah, you know, if more people in your family have dark hair, dark eyes, it's more likely to happen. But it's not uncommon for people to suddenly come out with blue eyes when nobody else in the family has it. It's just that combination, that, you know, blending of the two recessive traits, and suddenly you've got it. And then if it happens again, and then it happens again, and there's more breeding, it's going to happen more often.
You get two recessive dominants and it can pop. Exactly. It might just be one kid out of, you know, the four kids that you have, but it'll, if there's enough buildup, you're exactly right. And then the recessive dominant is now a dominant. And then, yeah.
Hey, this is Liz.
Hey, this is Heather.
And we are Nerdy Bitches Podcast,
a show where two geeky ladies podcast their way through pop culture.
From movies and TV to our regular book club and everything in between, we bring you our favorite fandoms with a feminine eye.
We are talking Star Wars, Star Trek, DC, Marvel, comic books, and anime.
And don't forget sci-fi, fantasy, action movies, video games, D&D, board games, and so much more.
Be sure to check us out on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever you find awesome podcasts.
You can also find us hanging out on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and at nerdybitches.com.
See you soon.
So we're talking hundreds and hundreds of years there where integrating with more and more, you know, European colonists, or who knows, put it this way. What if you didn't integrate, like, I should just say have sex. So you personally did not have sex with a European dude, right? Okay.
Okay.
But what if you end up married off to somebody in another tribe and turns out that his grandmother was a European colonist? And you wouldn't know by looking at him at all. But turns out, so then it gets now mixed into your tribe that way. But I mean, nobody had a clue. So yeah, it just, there's no way to know. That's my, I'm not tracking with how some folks are just totally certain that it's got to be from the Roanoke colony. But anyway, that's it. That's your scoop on Roanoke. And I think that I agree with that last historian that I mentioned, that it's most probable that the Roanoke folks split up, and of course their numbers likely got thinned anyway by disease and starvation and, let's get real, probably murder. But I think that's the most likely explanation, is that some of them went inland, like the original plan, and some of them went over to Croatoan, and they were like, the easiest thing to do to leave for Governor White, we're just going to pop Croatoan on here, that's what's easier. He'll go to Croatoan, you guys are going to be there. And y'all will be able to verbally tell him all these details about where we are inland, because that's too much to freaking carve. You know, we're not going to sit here for 8 days and carve fucking where we're going. We're just going to tell you guys, Croatoan, you just sail 60 miles, which would take not long at all for him. He'll come here. He'll see we're not there. He'll see the note, go to Croatoan. You guys are going to give him the scoop, and then he'll come find us.
Yeah, that's a plan.
That's it. I'm done. Now it's your turn.
So that's the mysterious mystery of Roanoke.
That, for me, is not mysterious at all. And it wasn't goddamn aliens, and it wasn't Indian witches in the woods, and it wasn't.
But are you sure? Can you say for sure?
Yes. I'm going to say for sure. And talking about that BuzzFeed Unsolved video, and Shane gave Ryan a hard time about it, but Ryan even threw in, and I didn't read this personally in my research, but apparently Ryan came across it in his, that there's theories about some sort of zombie virus that they turned into zombies. I mean, virus, sure. As we've learned, all it takes is one, and then you get, it'll spread pretty fast. But I doubt it, because I doubt it. I doubt that it was virus.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I'm sure in terms of infection, all these lovely, friendly, kind Native Americans that they were meeting, I'm sure they passed on some infection to them.
Smallpox and, yeah, all that good stuff.
But I don't know that. I think that would have been pretty evident pretty quick on the, what, 3-4 month journey on ship over. That would have reared its head pretty quickly. So, all right, you're up.
All right.
Take us to the Bermuda Triangle.
Yes. I'm so excited. All right. So here we go. The Bermuda Triangle, or maybe you want to call it the Devil's Triangle. It's just that mysterious area in the Atlantic Ocean. And I know we addressed it earlier, and you might be thinking, like, Tiff, really, the Bermuda Triangle? Yes, the Bermuda Triangle. Because while everyone has heard of it, when is the last time you actually paid attention to anything about it?
I don't know. I was about to say the Devil's Triangle sounds like something you would tell your esthetician, like, well, not your esthetician, whoever does the bikini waxes, you know what I mean? To be like, do you want a Brazilian today? No, I'd like a Devil's Triangle.
It sounds like a dirty sex move. It certainly does here.
Is that an Urban Dictionary? Somebody go look that up and let us know, because we're not going to look, because we're drinking wine and we're lazy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm going to shut up.
No, we're good. All right, so the Bermuda Triangle is just one of the 12 vial vortices located around the Earth. It's full of electromagnetic aberrations and subtle matter energy. You know, it's very, very complicated science. So the points of the triangle are at Miami, Florida, the island of Bermuda, and in Puerto Rico. Now, sometimes, depending on the source, the triangle could extend across the entire ocean all the way up to Ireland. But we're just going to go with the more sensible, and I think the more popular, 500,000 miles worth of triangle that spans from Florida to Puerto Rico to Bermuda. Long before planes and ships were disappearing, the triangle was causing confusion and concern. And this was even true for Christopher Columbus. As he sailed through the area on his first voyage to the New World, he reported that a great flame of fire crashed into the sea one night. And then he also wrote about erratic compass readings. And there will be a little bit more on that later. The Smithsonian reports that Bermuda was first discovered in the early 1500s by Spanish explorer Juan de Bermudez, and it was not actually settled until 1609 when the British ship the Sea Venture wrecked on the reef of Bermuda's shores on its way to Virginia. Now, a lot of the survivors were able to continue on to their destination, but three of the survivors stayed on the island. And then within 3 years, Bermuda became a British territory and has remained so to this day. Many believe that The Tempest by William Shakespeare was actually inspired by the wreck of the Sea Venture. It was nicknamed?
It had a neck beard.
It was nicknamed the Devil's Islands by early sea travelers, and it was because they were frightened by calls of kahow birds, which are these loud nocturnal seabirds, as well as squeals of the wild pigs that had been put onto the island. So, you know, imagine you're sailing at night and you're just hearing these freaking crazy seabirds all around and the pigs, and yeah, that would be terrifying. There has been a large number of suspicion and a few grand tales about the area for a lot of time before it actually became the Bermuda Triangle. Now, one source put the numbers in at about 50 ships and 20 aircraft over the past 500 years, which when you look at the numbers that way, that doesn't seem like a lot. Like I said, that's just one source. There are a couple other that bump those numbers up, but it's not like these huge lists of people or aircraft or ships that have gone missing. It's really kind of a concise list. But sources say that they vanish within the triangle, many without a trace, meaning no wreckage, no bodies, nothing to indicate what may have happened or where they may have gone. Many disappeared in reportedly calm waters without having sent any kind of a distress signal. And these are not just like little dinghies, little boats and with amateur sailors. We're talking about some pretty sizable ships and pretty experienced sailors. So a few of the more significant triangle mysteries, and I'm focusing on some of the full disappearances. You know, not the ones where you can actually look and be like, oh, they were flying in a storm. Gee, what may have caused complications there? No, these are the weird ones. So we've got the USS Cyclops. It disappeared after departing from Barbados on March 4th, 1918. There were 306 people on board. The passengers and crew were never found. The ship was officially declared lost and those on board deceased in June of that year. Now, like I said before, it wasn't a bunch of tiny boats that went missing in the ocean. This particular ship was 550 feet or 165 meters long. And this wasn't like a Titanic situation either. This ship had been successfully sailing across the Atlantic since 1910. In a feature published a couple of years after the ship's disappearance, Santa Fe magazine described the strangeness of it all. Quote, usually a wooden bucket or a cork life preserver identified as belonging to a lost ship is picked up after a wreck, but not so with the Cyclops. She just disappeared, as though some gigantic monster of the sea had grabbed her, men and all, and sent her into the depths of the ocean. And the suddenness of her destruction is amplified by the absence of any wireless calls for help being picked up by any ship along the route. Now later, and this I found interesting, in 1941, two sister ships of the Cyclops, the Proteus and the Nereus, were also lost in the same area, both also without a trace. So how about we move on to another ship though? The Carol Deering. Now this instance, it's not the ship that goes missing, but it's the crew. And here's the story. A lightship keeper named Captain Jacobson was aboard the Cape Lookout lightship in North Carolina, and he sighted the Carol Deering as it was bound for port on January 29th, 1921. The Carol Deering hailed the lightship. Some crewmen reported that the ship had lost its anchors, and they were supposed to tell the owners of the ship. And Captain Jacobson made a note about it, but he was having some radio issues, so he wasn't able to report it right away. Now, 2 days later, January 31st, another captain found the Carol Deering aground and helpless on Diamond Shoals. The sails were set, and its lifeboats were missing, but they weren't able to actually reach the wreck until February 4th, and they found that it had been abandoned. They said that the crew had vanished like ghosts. Gone with them were personal belongings, key navigational equipment, papers, and the ship's anchors. No trace of the crew or the ship's logs has ever been rediscovered.
And carved into the side of the ship was Croatoan. And the anchors. What?
I don't know.
That's the weirdest thing that you said out of all that. And the anchors were gone.
Yeah.
I guess they cut anchor. I don't know. But, I mean, they didn't, like, haul them with them.
That's the mystery, Nash.
They were on Croatoan. All they had to do.
Nobody pays attention to these obvious things. Come on. So like I mentioned before, though, it's not just ships that go missing. There are lots of incidents with planes going down. Now, one of the better known lost flights is that of Flight 19 in December of 1945. This was made up of a squadron of 5 torpedo bombers, and they were practicing flight patterns for bombing runs. At first, Flight 19's flights were just going as smoothly as the other 18 they had done that day. Taylor, the squadron leader, and his pilots were going over exactly as they had planned. They dropped their practice bombs. Nothing was wrong. Then shortly after they turned north for the second leg of their journey, something really strange happened. For reasons that are unclear, Taylor, the squadron leader, became convinced that his compass was malfunctioning and that the planes had been flying in the wrong direction. And then a front blew in and brought rain and winds and heavy clouds. And so then the squadron became insanely disoriented. "I don't know where we are," one of the pilots said over the radio. "We must have got lost after that last turn." So then all of a sudden Taylor starts reporting that they're over land, and he's convinced that he's hundreds of miles away from their last checkpoint, somewhere over Florida, and none of those reports were making sense to those who were on base. I read that they were instructed, if lost or, you know, disoriented, to head toward the sun. But of course, with cloud cover, that would have been pretty hard to do. So there was a lot against them at this point. Taylor made the decision to steer them all northeast, which would take them further out to sea. Some of his pilots kind of recognized that he was making a mistake. One of them actually over the radio said, "Damn it, if we would just fly west, we would get home." But they ended up zigzagging back and forth over the ocean, confused about their location and without any working navigational equipment, till finally the squad leader gave the order, "All planes close up tight. We'll have to ditch unless landfall. When the first plane drops below 10 gallons, we all go down together." A few minutes later, the radio communication was replaced with the buzz of static. Now, that evening, one of the boat planes that was searching for Flight 19 also went missing while flying over the area. There was never any wreckage found. There were never any oil spots. They were just all gone. Earlier that year, though, there had been another missing military flight that was working on radar training. They were meant to fly from Florida to the Bahamas, but they were last heard over the radio at 1:16 a.m. and then never seen again. There was a 10-day search afterwards, but again, nothing was ever found. After that, there were a number of other disasters, both in the air and on the water, a number of other planes that completely disappeared. One of the most recent plane incidents was actually in 2005. So it's not like it was early aviation days or anything like that. And granted, it was a pretty small plane, but still, these things are happening. So how do we go from a scary island full of loud birds to a scary supernatural triangle in the ocean? Is it aliens? Is it multidimensional portals?
No.
It could be.
No.
All right. So let me break down where we get the whole triangle thing from. Suspicion of the area started to get a lot of publicity around 1950, This was honestly probably because of the missing military planes that kind of kept building up, and having had the war ended, people were paying a little bit more attention. A writer named Edward Van Winkle Jones published an article about the collection of missing planes and boats up to that time. But who cashed in on the triangle aspect? Well, it was introduced by another writer named George Sand, who in 1952 wrote Sea Mystery at Our Back Door for a magazine. And then in 1964, we get The Deadly Bermuda Triangle by Vincent Gaddis. Now, he is credited with coining the phrase and giving us nightmares about entering that part of the Atlantic. So cool. Thanks, Vincent. And you know what? If I hope you go to show notes, because there's going to be plenty there for you to check out. He looks like the kind of guy that would want to give you creepy nightmares. He's that guy that was like smoking in dark corners. Just, you'll see. So, you know, for me personally, when I was looking into this, I was kind of surprised at how fairly recently we came to the conclusion that there was this crazy alien dimensional portal in the ocean that was shaped by a triangle. Like, how was that missed for so long? Well, part of it is probably just that we're paying better attention. Not to say that people back in the 16 and 1500s were totally okay with losing boats, but, you know, that's actually why we have insurance. Here's a fun little bit of history. You know Lloyd's of London?
Yeah.
It began with Edward Lloyd in 1688. He ran a coffee shop. And because it was so close to the river, it was a really popular area with ship owners and with captains who would come and exchange information and gossip and, you know, just kind of try and make some plans with all of their shipping. Now, he saw this as an opportunity because he was like, okay, all of you people are gathering here to do this. I want to make some money off of this. So he started renting out the tables to people, and they would sell insurance in the event of their ship not returning. So it was like the place to go to get your marine insurance for your boats. And then eventually businessmen grouped together. They started pooling their funds to share the risk in the event of a ship sinking. And they would write their names under the total amount of risk that they were willing to accept, which is where we get the term underwriter from in the insurance industry. So now you know that. I'm sure everyone's just like, wow, Tiff, that's great.
Today I learned.
You are welcome. All right. So it's certainly not that they were not paying attention to the ships that were sailing across the area. And let's consider that within the last 100 years, we've added a lot more traffic to the area by flying planes and by traveling across the sea. So those numbers are going to go up because there's more traffic in the area, just like with cars. Hello. So what is going on in the triangle? Well, it's partially located in what's called the Sargasso Sea, and it's the only sea in the world with no land borders. It's actually bordered by four ocean currents. We've got the North Atlantic Current, the Gulf Stream, the North Atlantic Equatorial Current, and the Canary Current. So you can imagine getting caught among the currents, or getting even more confused and scared when you wind up in the eerily calm waters that are in the middle of all of that, surrounded by these huge, huge, huge groups of seaweed, which is actually where we get the name of the Sargasso Sea. Many early sailors were actually worried that they would get tangled and pulled down by the seaweed as if it was some kind of a sea monster. So that might be where some of those legends come from. And then if we go back to the beginning, where we had that shipwreck, there are lots of dangerous reefs in the area. One source says, treacherous. Okay. Hang on.
Can I tell you something funny that I caught much later? It's very subtle, so I don't want you to be like, oh, fuck. Say grocers for me.
Grocers?
Okay. So about every other time, I think it was during the Axeman episode. About I'd say every other.
Would I say grocers?
Time. Yes.
I was probably thinking of grocery. So I was just like, grocer.
Well, why are you saying grocery? that begs another question.
Grocery at the grocery store.
Grocery. Like it's gross. Grocery.
The grocery store.
My grandmother pronounced it that way, so I'm not shitting on you at all. It's just, it's a very Southern thing that slipped into your vernacular that surprised me.
All right. I'm trying to...
I mean, that bell's done been rung, so we can't do nothing about it now, so...
Excuse me, I would like to retract all of the grocers that I said. Thank you very much. Just go back and edit it every time I say it with, like, the weird British guy. Grocer.
Grocer.
All right. This is going to be hard for me to say. Okay. Treacherous? Fuck. I can't do it. Okay. I'm changing it out. All right. So what I have here from the source, it reads as treacherous shoals. But
oh, well, they're just assholes. Why would they write that?
I cannot put that together with my mouth.
Shoals. That's a difficult. That's very difficult.
So yeah.
Say dangerous. So, what? Dangerous, I guess?
Yeah, that's what I'm going to go with. Because I'm sitting here, I'm like, nope, I'm not going to be do it. Not going to be do it. Shit.
Molly, you a danger girl. I'm leaving every bit of this in. This is too good. And I'm also going to leave in your squeaky ass chair.
Oh, Jesus. You know, they're just those things you have a hard time saying.
No, but that's a dick move. Treacherous show. Good night.
It is, right? Alrighty.
That's like rural juror. That's a 30 Rock reference for anybody who... I was a 30 Rock girl. I still haven't finished Parks and Rec, but I was a hardcore 30 Rock girl, and that was my favorite, the rural juror.
Yeah. Alrighty. So these shoals that are treacherous, how about that? I'll switch it up. And the reefs, they can be found all along the continental shelf. There are strong currents that go over these reefs, and so it just is a whole bunch of navigational hazards in this area. And then according to the National Geographic, it's also home to some of the deepest underwater trench... Mother bitch! Okay. According to National Geographic, it's also home to some of the deepest underwater trenches in the world. So the wreckage could settle miles and miles below the surface of the ocean. Most of the seafloor in the Bermuda Triangle is about 19,000 feet, or 5,791 meters down. But the Puerto Rico Trench dips down at one point to 27,500, or 8,229 meters below sea level. That shit is down there. You're not going to see it again.
It gone.
It gone.
It gone.
Goodbye. And then there's that weird compass magnetic thing. Yes, there actually was a time when, in that area where the Bermuda Triangle is, a compass would point true north. But polarity does shift around the globe, and that's actually not true of the area anymore. So people who are saying, oh, it's magnets in the area. Nope. Sorry. That time has passed. And then let's re-examine some of those ships that I mentioned. The Cyclops, as well as her sister ships, that all went missing. What could have made them go down in the first place? Something that may have contributed to it was that they were all sailing with cargoes of ore. And these, of course, were very dense, very heavy cargoes. There are multiple reports that the Cyclops was actually overloaded by the cargo. And this is documented when she initially set sail and when she had made a stop on the journey. So the combination of being off weight, who knows what could have happened in the sea. Maybe they got caught in a current. Maybe there was a wave that came through. Ship could have gone down really, really fast as she was so overweight. If she ended up in the trench, that could be why it wasn't detected.
Well, it sounds like you're fat shaming this ship, frankly. and I think a Kraken is a much more PC.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. All right. I apologize. I apologize for, you know, the Cyclops having too many oars, too many Oreos. I was trying to think of something for there and I came up with nothing.
No, Oreos is good. Oreos is good.
All right. And then how about the Carol Deering? There's a possibility that there was a mutiny explaining why the ship was abandoned. And then, of course, the sailors that took off in the lifeboats didn't fare well. Flight 19, Well, we know that they went down because they ran out of gas and they were lost in the ocean. And it's most likely that those planes sank really, really fast as they were very, very heavy, and that the crew had no time to get out and tread any water. You've got to consider that the ocean is massive. You've got currents that can cause objects to drift and end up far away. There are those trenches that are difficult or impossible to explore. You've got ship parts and plane parts that decompose, and lots and lots and lots of human error. So let me finish with one last Bermuda Triangle mystery, the SS Cotopaxi. In 1925, it left harbor in South Carolina and was headed for Cuba, but it got lost in the triangle along with the cargo and the 32-man crew. There was a Mayday signal that was issued from the ship, but no one ever knew what happened because, just like many of the other ships I've talked about, there was nothing ever recovered as wreckage. It was just gone. It was just another victim of the triangle. But thankfully, there are historians and explorers who know how to navigate the mysteries of these ships. And thanks to some intense detective work and lots of patience, the SS Cotopaxi was eventually found. It actually had been called Bear Wreck up until Michael Barnett and Guy Walters teamed up to find information that they needed to ID the ship correctly as the Cotopaxi. It was found not within the boundaries, as vague as they are, of their Bermuda Triangle. It was actually off the coast of St. Augustine, which is in the northern part of Florida. Further investigation found that the ship was notably not seaworthy before leaving for the voyage, but that warnings were ignored by the investors. So when a storm caught the ship, it basically didn't stand a chance. So something that went down even close to land like that was not found. There hadn't been any wreckage that washed up. So you got to really consider, what are the chances of finding clues to some of those other missing ships and missing planes out in the open sea? So for me, it's kind of, you know, you got to imagine what's yet to be found, properly identified, or is rotting away at the bottom of one of those ocean trenches.
Well, and like we said in the pirate episode, not terribly long ago, they just found the Queen Anne's Revenge.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew exactly where, well, pretty much exactly, they knew who nailed Blackbeard. I mean, they knew when he died. They knew the day he died. They knew what ship wrecked, absolutely wrecked the Queen Anne's Revenge. So they knew, but it was only in recent past that it was found. So yeah, the ocean, man, the ocean's fucked.
It's terrifying. The ocean is terrifying. I mean, don't they say that we've discovered less ocean than we have space?
Mm-hmm. Well, and relative, I mean, you know.
Relatively, yeah.
Yeah.
But for real, there's some shit down there. And, you know, it's not a mysterious magnetic alien-focused triangle. It's not, you guys. So it's a lot less mysterious than that, but it is still terrifying.
Yeah, I don't do, like, I have no desire to go on a cruise. I would go on like a day trip to go see whales or something, but
If I can't see the bottom and I can't touch the bottom, no, thank you. No. Like I will watch shows on TV where people are diving and going in the water. And I have fear for them. Like, it scares me watching it. Even if it's just like, oh, we're just doing a friendly dive. And
same.
I'm like, no, thank you.
Same.
Yeah. So there you go. That's the Bermuda Triangle, which is, you know, a very vague triangle.
A very what?
Vague.
Yeah. Vague.
Vague. Hey, I'm in the north, okay? We extend our vowels.
A very vague.
A vague. I also say bag.
Now we're back to Vag and that devil's triangle wax job that I want to get.
See, it all comes back.
And everybody's like, Nash, you bitch, have you heard your voice and your southern accent? And you're giving Tiff such a hard time. Look, listen.
It's out of love. I know. It's okay.
Well, I don't know if you mean it. See, sometimes I don't know if it's my southern ears are just hearing incorrectly or if it's a legit.
No, I probably would have just kept talking. Like, I'm not even aware. What else do I say? I say something else weird that it drives my husband crazy. I'm like, that's how it's said. I don't know what to tell you. Costume.
Yeah.
Yeah. He says that I say it wrong. Costume. Yeah. And often.
Yeah. What does he, Costum? I mean, I don't know what he could possibly...
He makes it sound like there's like a CH in there, like costume.
Costume?
Like costume.
Costume.
Costume? Costume.
There's no H. Once more, Tiff's husband is incorrect. He was incorrect about gremlins, and now he is incorrect about costumes.
Yeah. So, I don't know. That's the Bermuda Triangle that I was, you know...
Wait, like I want to talk more about things that people say wrong. Hey, all y'all people that say, well, I said it very harshly in a past episode. Mischievous, it's not a word. It's mischievous. Also, the people who say, oh, and I've also talked about Reese's cups. No, it's Reese's cups. It's not Reese's cups. And also, all y'all people that say jewelry. No, it's jewelry. Jewelry. It's not jewelry.
Oh, also espresso, not expresso.
It's not expresso. That's exactly right. It's espresso.
Espresso. Mm-hmm.
What else can we shit on people for? We've shit on their podcasts.
We shit on their mysteries. Mm-hmm. Sorry, guys. The triangle's not a mystery anymore.
Neither is Roanoke. I'm sorry. We'd apologize, except we don't mean it. Oh, I'll do you one better. Talking about mispronunciations. My great-grandmother, it would drive my grandmother and my mother batshit. The word crystal. She would say crystal. We have no idea how. How? Crystals.
You know, my mom, she, instead of saying idea, she always says ideal. I have an ideal. I'm like, you have an ideal what?
Oh my God. You know,
an ideal. Isn't that a great ideal? Like, I don't know about that.
Bless it.
Whatever. We're experts on everything.
We're experts on fucking everything.
I've been teased about my vowel usage for a long time.
Really?
Oh yeah. Well, because I grew up in Chicago. So I already had that, you know, bears, you know, Ditka, you know, that kind of thing going on from Chicago. So I had that going for me. And I had a friend named, it makes me pause even to this day, like 20 years later. It makes me pause to say this name because see, there it is. Because I'm so worried about mispronouncing it. Her name was Megan.
Yeah.
But she was like, no, my name is Megan. And I'm like, yeah, Megan. She's like, no, it's not like M-A-Y. It's M-E-G-A-N. I'm like, yeah, Megan. She's like, no.
Oh, I get it. Megan.
Yeah. Because gotcha. I was. Okay. Yeah. And so, like, I always had to sit there and pause and be like, M-E-E. Okay. E-E-E. Because she would be like, I'm not answering to you until you say my name properly.
Oh, geez, what a bitch. Mine that tripped me up was Jeremy. I would say, Mom said that I was...
Can you say Jeremy?
Jeremy, for years. And of course, there were two. There were two of them in my classes from like kindergarten to whatever grade, like third or fourth grade or something. Jeremy. And my mom said that I'd get real, like, I'd be like, yeah, and it was me and Holly and Jeffrey and April and Jeremy. Like, like my lips would warp and my head would tilt and Jeremy.
Sounds like a cassette tape that's like on its last legs.
I don't know how we got here.
I said vague. Vague.
All right, it's vague. Look, just don't sweat the Bermuda Triangle. Don't sweat Roanoke and keep listening. There's going to be an outro that tells you where we are on social media and how to get in touch with us. And we love hearing from you. And you can tell us what words you fuck up on a regular basis.
Please do.
We're on pins and needles. We just can't wait to hear.
Yeah. Let us know what other words we fuck up on a regular basis. I know we're pronouncing things incorrectly, so.
Well, I'm not, but no.
Okay. Oh, okay. Okay,
dreamer. No, to be sure. I have butchered, to be sure. And as bad as some of you may think my accent is now, oh, I promise. It was much worse. I've lived in Tennessee for longer than I've lived where I grew up, which was Alabama. And not deep, deep Alabama, middle of the road Alabama, but still Alabama. So this is a vast improvement from what it was. Still.
All
right, that's it. That's all we got.
Yeah, this is where the catchphrase goes.
You keep stealing my line. All right, say it again, and I won't stomp over it.
No, it's your line.
This is where the catchphrase goes.
With feeling, like you love it.
This is where the catchphrase goes.
Oh.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening. As a reminder, you can check out our sources for each of the episodes at show notes, along with any supplemental things we think you might enjoy.
Visit us on our blog at youtotallymadethatup.tumblr.com. You can also find us on Twitter at YTMTUpodcast and on Instagram at youtotallymadethatup. Feel free to contact us on those platforms, and you can also email us. That address is youtotallymadethatup@gmail.com.